All right, what I'm hoping to do today is to talk to you about the experiences of three different women that I had the chance to meet. I did an Eisenhower Fellowship in 2011, which is a mid-career leadership development fellowship that took me to Sweden and Kenya, and learned a lot about the way different countries look at healthcare, the way they look at women's healthcare and children's healthcare. And I chose Sweden and Kenya because if I'm in St. Louis, which is a city fairly similar to Boston, but probably about a third the size, there are parts of my city where healthcare outcomes are similar to Kenya's, and there are parts of my city that the outcomes are very similar to Sweden's. So I'm a hospital administrator by trade, and so when I first went into this, I assumed that infant mortality was all medical care, and it was the stuff we did inside the hospital, and found very quickly that that's actually probably the least relevant stuff that we do. You can see the list of factors there on the left, all the things from access and hygiene to transportation to the affluence of the country to environmental exposure. And I think that when you study infant mortality, you really learn very quickly that it's actually a study of women and children and their place in your society. And so through these three stories, what I'd like to do is talk you through what I believe to be the place of women in each of these societies. The first woman that you'll meet is named Gianna. I met Gianna when I was traveling in western Kenya. She was described to me as a woman who was about to die. When I went to Kenya, I think one of the things I learned very quickly was that Kenyans have a culture that can be best expressed as harambe, which is a term really that signifies how the community all comes together to work on solving problems. There's a tremendous amount of pride in Kenya, and I think most relevant for Gianna's case, there's an acceptance of struggle. So the fact that a lot of babies die in their first 5 years, that a lot of mothers die after childbirth, that people don't get their medical problems addressed, is something that Kenyans accept as really just part of life. They do have national health insurance with user fees. In theory, those user fees are not supposed to always be collected, but there's a lot of confusion among people like Gianna about when those fees need to be collected and when they don't. So this is her home in a Maasai village, just mud thatch home. And when I went and sat and talked with her, I'd expected to see a 50 or 60-year-old woman, the way she'd been described to me, and then realized she'd actually been 6 weeks out from having a C-section, had a horribly infected scar on her stomach. And when I asked her, why don't you go back to the hospital to get this fixed, her response was, very, very deadpan, very matter-of-fact. It was, I don't have 100 shillings to get a moped ride back to the hospital. And it was sort of chilling for me, thinking, in the United States, a woman with an infected C-section scar would go right back to the hospital, an ambulance would take her if she didn't have the funds to pay for it. Our hospital system is set up in a way that people who can't afford care receive care, and she would have been taken care of. Certainly not on a moped either, right? You would take an ambulance or a comfortable car to the hospital. But for lack of about $1.07, she was going to die in her hut. So as I think about that, it's really very chilling. In her village, 90 of 1,000 babies will die before their first birthdays. And had she lived on the other side of Kenya in a village named Lawala, where some American donors have put a hospital, two medical students came to the United States and came here to train and raise the funds to build this hospital. And the hospital is very important in the community, almost as important as the women who helped to run it. These are the Umama Salama, traditional birth attendants. And one of the things that the hospital did that was really smart is they partnered with the traditional birth attendants and actually went out into the community and said, we want you to work as our agents. We want you to work with mothers as you have in the traditional ways. We want to bring some more education to you. And we want you to preserve your status in the community, and we want you to preserve your income. Historically, sometimes you'll see Westerners come into Kenya and try and deliver the Western way of doing things without respect for local traditions, and it doesn't quite work. This works beautifully because these women keep their place in society, they're able to work, and they're able to help make sure that moms get safe deliveries. So now in a village of about 2,500 people, 95% of the moms deliver at the hospital. Infant mortality has been halved, and there's a growing fear of actually delivering at home. If Gianna had lived in the city in Nairobi, I know Nairobi's been in the news for some unfortunate things a lot lately, but I think Nairobi's a fairly established African city, maybe her care would be different. 60% of Nairobi's population, however, live in the slums. And so when you look at how healthcare might be in a place like this, where the running water is actually sewage running through where you live, healthcare is not always going to be the easiest thing for women to get access to. And if you live here, the way you're going to get to the hospital is you're going to take these matatus, these vans. They're like a private transportation system that's replaced the public transportation system. It's going to take about an hour to 2 hours, and it's going to cost about 2 to 3 days' wages for a woman to actually get to the hospital. So when you think about Gianna's place in her society and where she is, it's obviously not a privileged place. And I thought to myself after I met her, this could never, ever, ever happen in my country. It just wouldn't happen. I wish that were true. Anna lives in Sweden. And when Anna gets pregnant, she will have a very rich employer benefit if she needs to go out towards the end of her pregnancy, and will have a very different experience. In fact, Anna will have 480 days of maternal leave when she's finished having her child. Her partner will have to take at least 60 days of that leave, and those days have to be used before the child's 8 years old. So it's really very important to the Swedish culture that children are brought in into the world in a very different way than we do in the United States, that mothers are able to be caretakers, that fathers are able to be caretakers. You know, Sweden in one word is security, health security, food, education, housing, broad economic and personal financial. The Swedes have developed a system of social insurance, and it's not socialism, I was reminded during my trip there. It's social insurance that you pay as part of your taxes, and then you have many, many things that wrap around you, including fully funded healthcare system. There are some small user fees. There's the ability to go into a private system, but by and large, in Switzerland, healthcare is free for everyone. These things that I've described also apply to new immigrants. So a mother who moved to Sweden from Iraq or the Sudan or Somalia with small children would have all these same benefits provided to her by the system. That would enable her to get enculturated, to get those kids in school, to get them learning either Swedish or English so they could become educated. So there's a lot of protections built around kids and women in Sweden. Two phrases that seem, as an American, a little bit different than how we look at the world. Jantelag, which came from some Swedish literature, and there's a belief in the population that we're all equals. There's a phrase that says that, you know, the tall poppy is the one that gets cut. So there's a striving to make sure that everyone is able to do well. And if you think about it, if we were all hungry and we had a giant bowl of soup, we would all take just enough from that cup, the term lagom. So a very different viewpoint than I think we have in America. Anna lives in Södermalm, a very nice suburb. Great transportation, access, bus, subway, taxi, private car, clean housing, clean air quality, in a country where healthcare access is a civil right. And the healthcare core in Sweden isn't hospitals, as sometimes it tends to be in some countries, but it's really nurses. So when a child is born, they're assigned to what's called a Barnevard Central, which is a medical home. So for the first 6 years of that child's life, everything that happens is tracked by a nurse who has responsibility for that child. They behave like a third parent. And they really believe that if you're healthy in BVC, you'll be healthy for life. And when you look at things like obesity rates in Sweden, obesity rates among children are on average 6%, in some areas as low as 2%, compared with the United States, where I think we're approaching 30% now. You can see they've really put a focus on early child health so that you develop healthy adults. These scorecards that the nurses compare themselves on are publicly available. So when you see things like almost 100% vaccination rates, 100% prenatal care attendance, preterm birth rates below 6%, you're going to see much better infant mortality statistics than you see in Kenya and the United States. So in Anna's city, only 3 of every 1,000 babies will die. And generally, these are going to be babies that had congenital malformations that are contrary to life. So when you ask yourself, what's Anna's place in her society, it's a pretty nice place. It's a pretty equal place. Unfortunately, right now, this could never happen in my country either. We have a system that I'll describe now that's equally different. Mizonia. Mizonia is an African-American woman who lives in a pretty rough part of St. Louis. in our culture, I think, as the Americans in the room know, it's very individual. It's me, myself, and I. It's, you know, pull myself up on my bootstraps and do my best. I would reason that anyone who uses that phrase has probably not pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. I think, you know, we all got to where we got. I was very fortunate, born into a middle-class family, went to state schools on an Army scholarship. So everything about my education was government paid. So as an American, I can say I hate the government, but I sure benefited a lot from it, right? And everyone in our country does. And we have, you know, as we were talking before this, I mean, there are, you know, regions, countries in the world where you have regions that are unsafe that you can't go into. We have a government that makes that for us. But I think we, as Americans, have this sort of bifurcation with how we want to view our lives and how we view the whole society. We do, as many of you know, have an evolving coverage model that's very subsidized by businesses and by government. Not the most efficient model, but it's what we have right now. So Mizonia lives in an area that's pretty disadvantaged. There isn't good transportation. There are what we call food deserts around in the areas that Mizonia and folks like Mizonia live, where you really have trouble finding fresh fruits and vegetables, where it's not safe to travel, where you don't have the absence of crime, where your kids can't just go outside and play. So a very different experience than what Anna experienced. 20 in her zip code, 20 or more per 1,000 babies will die each year that are born. Another place with 20 or more babies per 1,000 dying is in Kibera. There's a recent study I came across actually while I was preparing this presentation that said in Kibera the rate is about 20 per 1,000. So much better than 90 per 1,000, you know, in the rural Maasai villages, but certainly we can do better, I think, than this. In the United States, I think you have to ask yourself, where do women and children fall in our society? And the numbers are very small, but you can see the red arrows, and that's the path that we've taken from 1960 to 2009. We were 11th among the developed countries in terms of our level of infant mortality. In 2009, we'd slipped to 46th. 2012, the study was done again. We actually slipped off the page. We're now, I think, 52nd or 53rd. When I was in Sweden, I got asked about that a lot. Wonderful questions. Why is it that the United States doesn't give health care to everyone? Why is it that children show up at your emergency room and turn away if they can't pay when you're such a rich country? If you want babies to be born healthy, why don't you give young women access to health care? And explaining to someone that, well, they do get access to health care as soon as they're pregnant, ignores the whole life that happened before that pregnancy and really leads to some unfortunate birth outcomes. And so if you don't have access to care, this was a study that we did in St. Louis for you know, women like Mizonia, why don't you get prenatal care? She didn't have money, didn't have the ability to get there in terms of transportation, didn't know how to access the care, couldn't get time off from work. So again, compare this with Anna's experience where their employer is going to make sure that you're able to get the care you need and work with you to do that versus Mizonia, who really has to struggle to get the basic care she needs. There are some hidden gems. The St. Louis Healthy Start program is a wonderful program that's designed to reduce infant mortality and improve the outcomes for babies. Lots of home visitation, lots of group care, lots of different interventions that go beyond medical. Unfortunately, it only can serve about 120 mothers per year. So in a city where we have about 30,000 births, about half of those to moms who are on Medicaid, you can see it just touches a very, very small number of women. These broad variety of services are medical, they're mental health, they're case management, they're outreach, and a lot around group education. I think one of the things we found is that group pregnancy classes, the moms who go through those have much better outcomes, their babies have much better outcomes, and we're able to address not just their medical needs, but their mental health needs as well. And you can see some of the results here. I think the biologic results are very good. The integration into primary care settings and in medical homes is very good. And the number of referrals that are actually completed for moms to get the services they need in the community are very good. So what's Mizonia's place in her society, right? And I picked a woman in America who we might call disadvantaged, but the reality is half our babies in the United States are born to women who are on Medicaid. And so many of them, regardless of their backgrounds, are going to have experiences like Mizonia. I think, you know, as I reflected on what I learned traveling through these three countries looking at these issues, in the United States we choose our problems, right? I work in a hospital that has a NICU that is 72 beds. We're growing it to 136 beds over the next 10 years. It's going to be very, very expensive to society for that. You can see in the scatter plot, $1 million is not uncommon for babies to be through our NICU in a year. Certainly if you go to the 400,000 line, lots and lots of babies. So we'll spend $1 million for a NICU baby, but we won't necessarily spend what we need to spend for public health nursing. So that's the quick look at each of those health systems through the eyes of these women. And, you know, I think that I learned a lot as a hospital administrator about public health going through this. You know, I sort of joke that, you know, we get to do our job when governments don't give money to you to do yours in public health. If we had a 90-10 split that was 90% public health and 10% hospitals, we'd be a better country, a better world for that. Unfortunately, that's not where we are. In closing, I just want to tell you, the woman, Gianna, actually, we took her to the hospital. We sort of scuttled our day's plans and took her back to the hospital. I got this email a couple of days later which said, hope you reached home well. We are doing well here in Kenya and we have no rain till now. The mother is doing well and the surgeon will repair the operated site tomorrow and she will be fine. So wonderful, wonderful outcome for this mom. Didn't anticipate that this would be part of the journey that went on, but truthfully, this is probably the thing that was the most meaningful for me in learning about infant mortality across these three countries. So with that, I'll close and ask if there are any questions. All right. Yeah, this was a question I asked you a lot, because on this Eisenhower Fellowship, you travel around, you meet with all different kinds of people, and so I met with a lot of government officials and asked them this question. I think that, you know, the Swedes have a tolerance and an acceptance of everybody, but they do want you to become a Swede, and that's part of what they've built. So I think for new immigrants who want to, you know, in America we have lots of areas, you know, in each of our cities in America we have parts of the city where the language that's spoken most commonly is not English. Right, and in our bigger cities, we have 40 of those areas. In Sweden, there's a little bit of that, but they really try and get people enculturated much more quickly. It has caused some tension in the last probably 10 years. You see some right-wing groups that are starting in Scandinavia to pop up a little bit. But I think it is one of those things that they really feel like to be a Swede, you can ethnically be from somewhere else, but these principles that we talked about are really, really important for you to embrace. So there is some tension around that. And about 12% of the population is immigrant population.
And then do they find that the health outcomes of the immigrant population, you know,
if
we kind of have an immigrant here in America, is there something similar there, or do you find
that
because they're so well integrated that they have?
So their outcomes are better, but they're not as good as the rest of the Swedish population. I mean, and, you know, interesting, right? If you're an African woman, and you move to the United States, very soon your health outcomes, regardless of your family history, become like our country's, right? So you think you bring a genetic profile, biologic profile with you from your heritage, but when you look at all the things that influence things, I mean, you know, you look at institutional racism and the effect it has on healthcare in our country, the lack of transportation and access and those things that a lot of us in this country have to deal with, I mean, those things play into it. So. Yeah, I think that in Sweden it is better. I think it's much better to be an immigrant than in other places, but there still are challenges. Okay, thank you.